Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting live and video streaming from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, the latest on health and healing. Good news if you are eating organic, because I'll tell you how many studies actually show that organic is far superior than traditionally grown food or genetically engineered food. Also today, we'll give you the latest on what vitamin D is doing and what coconut is doing to help our brains and to prevent cancer. Then from our environmental segment today, we're going to talk about individuals who've been wanting to get back to the land. And there are millions of those individuals. Many people who came from heartland America, Kansas, Indiana, Illinois, they want to get back there. I'm going to suggest think for a moment, because the storms that are now happening on a regular basis on the Great Plains stir memories of the Great Dust Bowl. So from Reuters today, I'll talk about why it is not the place to relocate to. Also today from George Monbiant from The Guardian, this past year, we did our best to abandon the natural world. Also climate warnings, and something that all of us have seen if you travel, as I do, and get into the woods, the higher elevation where historically you would see great forest, those forests are being devastated because of global warming, because of beetles, bark beetles. How's that happening? I'll talk about that. Also today, a commentary. The commentary is everything we tell ourselves about America and the world is wrong, by Charles Eisenstein from Alternet and myself. I wrote an extensive commentary last night that will interweave with Charles's the story of our lives, the story that we are told, the story that we believe. We need a new story. My guest today will be Michael Hudson. Professor Hudson is arguably one of the most important progressive economists in the world. He'll be on in about 10 minutes, and he's going to take a look at what actually happened when it came to this cliff deal. Not what we were told. Let's begin. I can remember growing organic produce and taking it to my friend Dave, who owned Fairway. This is at the very beginning of Fairway Supermarket. Now it's a massive chain. At that time, I had a farm upstate New York and in Goshen as well, in the Black Dirt area. Black Dirt's the richest soil in America. It's so rich that when you walk on it, the ground actually shakes. You can just take your hand and take it right into the soil, right up to your elbow. Whatever you grow, it grows rich because the minerals are so rich. I took an old farm, an onion and celery farm that had gone broke, and rehabilitated it. And in just 40 acres, was able to grow enough produce that every Friday a truck would pull up, a giant truck, and would deliver produce up and down the East Coast. So I would take organic produce in to Fairway. And he would offer the produce at less than his regular produce. So you'd have a head of organic lettuce, let's say for a dollar, and a head of regular lettuce for $1.50. He couldn't give it away. And after about 3 months of this, he said, Gary, we're just not able to sell it. We throw it all away. And we couldn't figure out why. Why would people not buy it? But they wouldn't. Not at that time. I had a little health food store, a little tiny hole in the wall. It's still there, by the way. I think it's the oldest health food store in New York City. And my produce section was very small because there wasn't a great deal of availability. I grew most of mine upstate at my own farm. But again, people didn't buy a lot. A health food store back then was more about selling granola bars, or what were called tiger bars, than selling organic produce. A lot of people have misconceptions that it's very expensive, that there's no difference, and it's something that kind of elites use. Nothing could be further from the truth. The number one consumers of organic produce in the world are the poorest people in the world. It is because they cannot afford the pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, and genetically engineered seeds that they're using, what are called heirloom seeds. These are seeds that have been passed down generation to generation. And it's done very simply. Let's say that you grow amaranth. Well, you don't harvest it all. You take the seeds and you store them. You store them in some dry clay pots or some other storage container for the next year. You grow tomatoes. You keep aside, you know, maybe 500 tomatoes. You open them up and let them dry. You take the seeds out and you'll have hundreds of seeds per tomato, and that's your next season crop. That's organic growing. It's relatively new to most of the suburbs in the United States and some of the urban areas where you've had farmers markets. Remember, the farmer market came first to the urban environment before the suburban environment. And most people in the suburbs had to drive into an urban environment to get their organic. Now that's not the case. You can go into suburban environments to get produce. In fact, some people choose to go to the farms themselves. And as the suburbs have expanded, what was an isolated organic farm in New Jersey 30 years ago, now is completely surrounded by a suburban environment. Then the question still is out there. Is it any better? This is what's out here right now, today. 40 new studies have been published providing a firm scientific basis that the argument is absolutely, unequivocally, yes, organic plant foods are more nutritious and provide an average of 25% more nutrient values. There were 97 published studies comparing the nutritional quality of organic and conventional foods that show organic fruits, vegetables, and grains contain higher levels of 11 nutrients studied, including significant greater concentrations of polyphenols and antioxidants. And this is the new report, State of Science Review, by the Organic Center, entitled New Evidence Confirms Nutritional Superiority of Plant-Based Organic Foods, is online. We have published it on our site. So no longer should there be any doubt. Buy local, buy organic. And now organic is very popular in health food stores, produce, and in part it's because of a higher education within the baby boomer generation and their children, realizing the dangers of pesticides, the dangers of let's say, factory farming methods. They don't want those in their bodies or their children's bodies. And organic baby foods is just booming. Again, ask the average mother who comes in to buy the baby food. Why are you buying this baby food, the organic applesauce, organic peas and corn? And she will say, I don't want chemicals in my child's body. I want my child to have the healthiest, purest food possible. That's not cultism. That's not quackery. That's an informed, educated consumer. And that movement is growing. Now, another thing is just beginning to grow, and that is the awareness of how powerful raw organic coconut oil is. It's great for your scalp. Take one teaspoon, massage it into your scalp at night, onto the scalp and into the hair. Great conditioner for overnight. It's also good if you have chafing on your heels and on your knees and elbows. Very good there as well. But it's best taken internally. One teaspoon or tablespoon of organic raw coconut oil, and sometimes it's clear and liquid, and sometimes it's cloudy and semi-solid. Doesn't matter. It's all the same. Here's what it does. This is just the latest study. This is from Health Impact News from Brian Shilhavy. It says, the news about how effective coconut oil is in treating Alzheimer's disease is spreading fast. As news about the failure of drugs in treating Alzheimer's continues to make headlines, just recently drug companies Pfizer and Medivation admitted that the new drug they were developing for Alzheimer's, Diepenbon, not only did not help the patients in trials, but made patients worse. The expensive drug had already reached phase 3 trials. In May of this year, a federal judge ruled that a case against Harvard Medical School and its teaching hospitals regarding fraudulent research using public funds for Alzheimer's disease was to proceed. So as the development of this drug has now been abandoned, and so many other potential drugs have also failed, possibly due to fraudulent research, many are beginning to look at the role of diet in Alzheimer's and focusing on prevention. People are also becoming aware of the positive results in using coconut oil to reverse the effects of Alzheimer's. One of the most recent studies that looked at the role of nutrition in Alzheimer's was published in the European Journal of Internal Medicine. And there was an article entitled Nutrition in Alzheimer's Disease, Detrimental Role of a High Carbohydrate Diet. The authors of this study have noted how researchers have begun to direct their energies towards understanding the earlier stages of Alzheimer's, since drug research in its later stages have not been very successful. And then they also found that what's good for Alzheimer's is also good for diabetes, but they're also calling Alzheimer's type 3 diabetes. Now, this is the first time I've heard about this. This is very interesting because they're saying that the very type of diet, high in refined carbohydrates, simple sugars, that cause diabetes and dysinsulinism and metabolic syndrome is the same identical diet that leads to Alzheimer's. Therefore, it would make sense that if you're causing inflammation in your arteries, inflammation in your spleen, in your pancreas, and dysfunction, dysregulation, you're causing the same inflammation in your brain. You're inflaming the neurons in the brain. And therefore, the same diet would work. And I would agree with that. And then they talk about the whole idea of the coconut oil and how it's helping turn off inflammation and how it helps. And here's what it says. I'll quote this. Coconut oil is highly saturated and in its natural unrefined form has a shelf life of 2 years or more. It is not prone to oxidation. The study from the European Journal of Internal Medicine referenced that Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and ALS all have an association with mitochondrial dysfunction. A study showed that coconut oil in the diet enriched in saturated fatty acids offered strong advantages for the protection against oxidative stress in heart mitochondria. Much research has also been done on what it does to enhance HDL cholesterol levels, lowering LDL cholesterol levels. An article in the American Journal of Cardiology supports that. And another major advantage the saturated fat of coconut oil provides is its ability to provide a brain with an alternate source of energy in ketones. Now, we know that ketones are high-energy fuels that nourish the brain. Our body can produce ketones from stored fat while fasting or in starvation, but they can also be produced by converting medium-chain fatty acids in certain foods. Well, coconut oil is nature's richest source of these medium-chain triglycerides. A study on coconut oil and these medium-chain triglycerides, and which was given to Alzheimer's patients. A control group got a placebo. They observed significant increases in the ketone body beta-hydroxybutyrate 90 minutes after treatment when cognitive tests were administered. Higher ketone values were associated with greater improvement in paragraph recall than the placebo group. So quite simply, the Alzheimer's patients benefited by having coconut oil. Now, mind you, this is not the only thing they should have, but that's one good thing that's inexpensive and easy to get. And also one final word here. This is from Susan Patterson, Natural Society. She says that if you go to bed too late, if you sleep too little or just don't sleep very much, you could be jeopardizing your health. And while the inconsistencies in sleep patterns have been tied to health problems such as weight gain and increased breast cancer and an impairment in overall alertness, it doesn't stop there. In one study, researchers found that men who did not have a healthy deep sleep habit were 80% more likely to develop elevated blood pressure than those who slept well. So, poor sleeping habits, they looked at 800 men, they found you're raising your blood pressure level, and that could cause you to die prematurely. So, here's my suggestion. A lot of men tend to eat after dinner at night. Don't. Cold water, lemon juice in the water, ice cubes in the water help kill your appetite. Make sure the room is completely dark. Also, take a nice hot shower before you go to bed, or even a hot bath for 10 minutes with Epsom salts. That relaxes the muscles. If you took 1,000 milligrams of magnesium, that relaxes the muscles. If you sleep on a very firm mattress, which is the only mattress people should sleep on, that helps you get to sleep. And if you need extra, take 5-hydroxytryptophan or melatonin, and that gets you into a deep sleep. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. My guest is online now. Professor Michael Hudson is one of our nation's important economists and Wall Street financial analyst. He's currently the president of the Institution for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends and was the chief economic policy advisor for Dennis Kucinich in his last presidential campaign. He is a research professor of economics, University of Missouri at Kansas City, and a research association at the Levy Economics Institute at Bard College. And he's also an author, and one of his latest and most important books is The Bubble and Beyond, Fictitious Capital, Debt Deflation, and the Global Crisis. And you can find more of his recent writings on michaelhudson.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary.
I want to begin with a short comment from Matt Stoller from Naked Capitalism. I'd like your comments on it, and then you give us your perspective on this debt cliff and how now Wall Street today is up almost 275 points, NASDAQ is up over 70, because hooray, hooray, it's all been resolved. And here's what Matt says. These are the things that we're not paying attention to that was a part of the corporate subsidies that were built into the fiscal cliff bill. One, help out NASCAR. Section 312 extends the 7-year recovery period for motor sports entertainment complexes. What that means is they're going to give them a $43 million allowance there. $100 million or so for railroads. That's in Section 306. That's worth $165 million. Disneyland got EAT, Section 317, extension of special expensing rules for certain film and television production so they can write off anything and everything they want. That's about $150 million. Help a brother mining company out, Section 307. Section 316 offers tax incentives for miners to buy safety equipment and train their employees on mine safety. Taxpayers shouldn't have to bribe mining companies not to kill their workers. Subsidies for Goldman Sachs headquarters, Section 328, extends, quote, tax-exempt financing for York Liberty Zone, which was a program to provide post-9/11 recovery funds. Rather than going to small businesses affected, however, this was, according to Bloomberg, quote, little more than a subsidy for fancy Manhattan apartments and office towers for Goldman Sachs and Bank of America employees. That's $1.6 billion tax-free financing for them. And last three here, $9 billion offshore financing loophole for banks, Section 322, is an extension of the active financing exception to subpart F. That means that they will be able to keep a lot of money that otherwise they have to pay taxes on, and tax credits for foreign subsidies, and bonus depreciation research and development tax credit. So all these are also, and that's worth $110 billion. So when you look at who really benefits, since no one ever reads these carefully, not even the legislators, no one's aware of what's in all this arcane language in there, what does it really mean? What did we actually do? And how is this going to impact the average person? The forum is yours.
Well, Naked Capitalism is my favorite website. I have articles on it every day this week, precisely on the question of the so-called fiscal cliff that actually was planned over a year ago when President Obama appointed the Bowles-Simpson Commission. He said, look, we're going to outline what the crisis is going to be on December 31st, 2012, so that we're going to force government to do really what I want. And what he wants to do is essentially what George Bush tried and was unsuccessful at. He wants to essentially downgrade Social Security, turn it into a privatization plan, and turn it over to the Wall Street banks. His election campaign to his contributors was he can do for Wall Street what the Republicans couldn't do because he can deliver the Democratic Party, which is what the Republicans couldn't do. And the Republicans helped him by going so far to the right that it actually made Mr. Obama's anti-labor policy look as if it were logical and reasonable compared to Romney. So it's important to look at what the newspapers and the television are misrepresenting. First of all, taxes did go up, mainly on labor, mainly on people earning less than $115,000 a year. As of today, the worst and most regressive tax of all, the payroll tax, went up from 4% to over 6%. That means that people are going to have over $100 to $150 of their monthly paycheck taken out to put into Social Security to provide the government with enough money to continue to cut taxes on Wall Street, on real estate, and on finance. So this is part of the Obama plan, essentially to gut Social Security, just like his former manager, Rahm Emanuel, has been gutting the labor unions and pension funds when he became mayor of Chicago. If you want to see what Mr. Obama is doing against labor, look at what Emanuel is doing in his fight to break up the labor unions, to break up the educational system, to defund pensions and just grab them, and to essentially defund public spending in Chicago. That's pretty much the plan of Obama. And the New York Times today had a wonderful sort of example. If you look at the front page, it basically says, the future of America, Obama style, is Latvia. And I've said on your program before that President Obama's plan is to cut wages in America by 30%. That is exactly what Latvia did. And the New York Times is saying, this is a great success story. This stabilized things, and yet Latvia's lost one-third of its population of working-age people. It's, if America were like Latvia, 20 million Americans would be emigrating over the next 3 or 4 years. So this is what Mr. Obama and the New York Times is holding out as stability is actually the kind of austerity that's being described as imposed on Greece, on Ireland, on Iceland, on Latvia. This is the first move in what's going to be a really vicious austerity plan, and Mr. Obama had to do it yesterday because there will be an incoming Congress that is not quite as right-wing, not quite as Republican, and essentially, if you're going to have Mr. Obama's Republican plan passed, he had to do it while the Republicans would support it, and they had to organize it sort of orchestrated like a World Wrestling Foundation federation wrestling match. They had to make it dramatic. They had to make it appear as if there was really a fight to do it at the last minute when almost all of the Wall Street people had seen that it was all being orchestrated in advance. So it's all a charade to convince people that austerity is necessary and good for them. Cutting back Social Security is necessary to stabilize the economy, meaning give more money to the campaign constituency on Wall Street, and lead to the privatization of the Social Security so that the Social Security recipients can have their funds looted in the same way that Goldman Sachs and the other Wall Street firms have looted the pension funds of California and other cities.
Let's take a look for a moment at The Nation magazine and the corporate Democrats, the Clinton and Obama Democrats, that have supported these programs, and then compare them to authentic and true liberals who have been excluded from any dialogues, any credibility, any forums, unless it's some alternative forum. And the same is true for the conservatives, those who do not go along with the current corporate Republican and corporate conservative ideology versus those who hold a different perspective. When we look at all the mistakes that are being made, they're not made unintentionally. You're telling us these are intentional. Are you telling us now that we are going to be looking at the United States being given the programs, different names for them, but pretty much an austerity program that Greece has, that Spain has, that Portugal has, that Slovakia has, that's going to come to the United States, and that this will be sugar-coated in some way to make it seem as if this is the only way that we can prosper and go forward? Is that what you're saying?
That is certainly the intention of the Obama administration. I don't believe he's going to sugarcoat it. I think you're now going to see as much of an iron fist as you've seen with the FBI infiltrating the Occupy Wall Street movement. There's nothing sugarcoating about the way Obama's doing it. What he said is that America should be like Greece in the following sense. Greece and the Eurozone do not have a central bank to just create the money to fund the government. What Mr. Obama is saying is, we have a central bank that can create the money. We don't have to tax. We can print the money. We've printed $13 trillion to give to Wall Street to bail out, but we are not going to give a penny of money creation to bail out the Social Security recipients. We're not going to give a penny to bail out labor. This is the class war, and he's taken the gloves off. This is not going to be a pretty sight, Gary. This guy is, Mr. Obama was a Republican who his advisors said, look, you're working for the real estate and banking interests in Chicago, run as a Democrat, and you have your own constituency. We want a Republican to run as a Democrat and essentially bring the party way, way to the right. And that's what he's doing now. In this second administration, you're going to see him insist on a balanced budget, which means the government is not going to be creating money to put into the economy, into the production and consumption sector, the real economy. The government is only going to create money, as a central bank is doing, the Federal Reserve with its quantitative easing, only print money for Wall Street, not a penny for labor. This is class war, and it's not pretty.
Michael, I don't have to remind this audience that you were one of the advisors, if not the chief advisor, to Iceland when they were faced with having to pay back the money that happened, they were owing to the bankers after their collapse. And instead of paying back the money and keeping in debt peonage for the next 100 years, it was advised by you and some others, don't pay them back, just get rid of the debt, say it's gone, forgive the debt, and start over. Even if they throw you under the bus, you'll recover. Well, lo and behold, Iceland is now recovering.
Well, that's really not, that's a cover story, but it's not the case at all. Iceland is not recovered. It's in as bad a situation as Latvia is. All of its foreign reserves are borrowed from the IMF, International Monetary Fund, to pay the crooks that took over the banking system. The Icelandic economy is broke. There's going to be an election this April on to try to throw out the regime that's bankrupted them, but Iceland has followed the same model as
Greece?
Latvia. The newspaper is applauding Iceland as a success story, claiming that it didn't repay, but that's simply not the fact. And again, if you read the Naked Capitalism site, it had a very good article on Iceland yesterday showing how it's true that people like Paul Krugman have written columns applauding the vulture banks and said, look, the vulture banks are the hope for Iceland. But that's the right-wing take on Iceland. And Iceland is a disaster story for anyone who really follows it, which you're not going to be able to do from following the American press.
Final thought for you. Give us an idea of what you see over the next 12 to 24 months happening to the 270 million Americans who are in various economic states. The single mother, 74% of all single parents, mainly women, work extra hours, meaning they put in more than a 40-hour work week. And yet all the programs being proposed now are to cut any additional subsidies to them. To the poor working class who are working one or more jobs, underpaid in the jobs they're working, cannot have a living wage, don't have adequate health insurance or any health insurance, and yet they're invisible. To those who have looked and can't find work and have simply ceased looking, over 5 million. To the poor, and now that's reached almost 100 million, to the 18 million hungry children. You add all that up, it comes to $270 million. Now, there's still plenty of people who, tens of millions, who are upper middle class, wealthy, super wealthy, and the mega wealthy, who are doing fine. I'm only asking you to address those who are suffering. What is the likely outcome for them in the foreseeable future?
This is exactly the problem, Gary, that you're correct to bring up this as the major problem. Many of these people work for minimum wages, and especially in the retail sales. The retail sales are falling off right now because people are still having to pay off the debts that they ran up prior to 2007. So much money is now being diverted to pay the banks that they are not having much left in their budgets to buy for goods and the products that are produced. So certainly in Manhattan, in Queens, you have whole blocks of stores that are now closing down. The Christmas season was not good for the small retail stores. And this means that employment is not going to be good for people earning the minimum wage, for single mothers and other people that really don't have much of a support. And it's noteworthy that the Democratic Party made no attempt at all to raise the minimum wage or no attempt to promote fuller employment. All of the efforts have been to restore the profitability of the banks, which are way up, to restore the profitability of the stock market, but not to restore wage levels, especially at the bottom of the social pyramid. And the belief by the Obama administration is if you can force state and local governments to begin to cut back employment, if you can create more unemployment, then wages are going to go down, and they believe that that will make America more competitive. And it won't, because low wages are just going to shrink the market here. It's going to already you're having real estate malls, shopping malls closed down. What I see is economic shrinking here. So I think that while the market was up today because of Obama's giveaway to Wall Street, it's going to drift down as sales and profits decline for the country as a whole.
Just one post statement here. If you could speak with the editors of The Nation magazine who were so supportive of Obama and gave no real attention to third-party candidates, Jill Stein or Rocky Anderson or Gary Johnson or others, what would you say about this unbridled support, assuming that Obama would be a better choice than Romney? Now, in retrospect of what we see Obama's actually done from his original promises, honoring none of them, and what he's likely to do now that he has no fear because he's a lame duck president.
Well, the people I speak to at the Nation didn't really say Obama was a better choice. They said he was a least less bad choice. But I don't think they're looking at the whole system, that it's part the Democrats and the Republicans are working hand in hand. The Republicans have to appear to be so crazy that it makes Obama look like the less bad choice, whereas the New York Times today said what he's just passed in the tax bill yesterday was the dream of the Bush administration. So Obama has achieved the dream that Bush couldn't do, and one should say simply that he's a bad choice. What I think the Nation and other magazines should be talking about is whether we're finally going to see a political realignment in this country where the labor unions and labor and the others realize that the Democratic Party is no more on their side than the Republican Party, and if they want someone on their side, they're going to have to create a new party and a new political movement, because the alternative under Mr. Obama is a wolf in sheep's clothing. He's going to privatize Social Security and essentially make America look like Greece.
What do you see happening with Greece?
Further decline. They're obviously very sorry that they didn't vote for the further left party. So Greece is polarizing between a kind of neo-Nazi party, the Golden Dawn on the right, and Syriza, the left-wing party. So you're going to see a polarization there. The Americans, I'm told, the CIA has already moving back in to put a new regime of the colonels back in with the targeted assassinations. So you're going to see Mr. Obama's drones over Greece, although they may be in the form of just pistols from the CIA boys that he's sending over to shoot the people who are opposing the pro-bank policies that are being imposed.
Very much appreciate your input. As always, thank you very much for being on today.
Thank you, Gary.
Professor Michael Hudson with his perspective. Now for a commentary. I've mentioned many times that I believe that frequently we are stuck in our stories. Individuals have stories, groups have stories, whole industries have stories. And our identity frequently comes from how we are positioned within them. This morning on my overnight program on our sister station, KPFK, I talked about what it means to be a corporate Democrat, a corporate Republican, a person that needs to believe in something greater than themselves. So they believe in the group think. They have their ideologue heroes, the Bill O'Reillys on the right, or those on the left who will talk for them on behalf of them. So if they're angry, then that anger will be expressed by those in the media on their behalf. And then I talked about those who then wonder, is there another way to look at the world? Does it have to be this way? Do we have to have 18 million hungry children? Do we have to have 45 million Americans currently homeless whose homes have been foreclosed on? Do we have to have a banking system that receives all the benefits and gives none of the special kindness or thought or compassion to those, like forgiving interest on student loans or forgiving credit card debt, instead doubling down to get as many people on compounding interest and late interest fees as possible? And so they go and they look out the keyhole and they see that there's another world. It's the world of the progressives, the independent thinkers, the people once were in that body of belief with them, but now are separate. They see it differently. And what happens is we now take a look through this keyhole and we see things that startle us, excite us, inspire us. But then we never get to the point of opening the door to walk into that room. We have to stay because our security is all important. And we're led to believe that there's a shortage of everything, a shortage of love, of compassion, of money, of trust. So we must continue to believe in the people we've associated with because they're the only ones who provide us with an answer. Now, then we see sometimes people that once were like us, a Linus Pauling in Science, who says vitamin C can help prevent or cure cancer. But now he's out of the room and no longer is he even discussed, not even in whispered breath, because he defied us. We no longer see Michael Hudson or Joseph Stiglitz, leading economists, even Nobel Prize winners, because they're out of the room. They're talking about a humanistic form of economic incentives and understanding. We no longer see the holistic doctor in the room with his orthodox compatriots, or the holistic nurse. They're out of the room. Therefore, their entire perspective has changed. It's altered. It's different. They can look at the real cause of disease. They can understand the real nature of healing. They can bridle that human instinct to heal through thought and through detoxification and through alignment with nature and natural vibrations. And yet, most people don't even go to look out that little keyhole into a different reality. They are so convinced that all that they need is keep believing. So when they feed themselves food that create obesity and epidemics of overweight diseases, diabetes, heart disease, cancers, fibromyalgia, they do not question the very corporations that are creating the foods, selling it to them in their fast food franchises, giving them the drugs that have never really been tested against gold standards of independent science and placebo. They take the vaccines with the truth that the vaccines are safe and effective individually or collectively because someone told them so. And if it wasn't, would all those doctors and nurses and pharmacists be giving it to their own kids and themselves? So how could they, the non-expert, believe otherwise? And yet they look out and they see people who were the nurses and the doctors and the pharmacists who are now saying, no, I looked at the research, I looked at the truth. And when I found the truth, it did not show safety or efficacy for any vaccine, individually or collectively. And you use common sense, and one of the people say, friend, let me ask you, if you took 1,000 people and you gave them 1,000 milligrams a day of vitamin C and you gave another group a vaccine at the end of the year, 5% of one group got the flu and 5% of another group to flu, would you say that 95% of the people taking vitamin C were protected because of vitamin C? No one will give you that advantage, but you'll definitely say that 95% of the people that did not get the flu, it was because of the flu vaccine. We accept legitimate scientific theory and thought and rational analysis in the one, and we reject it in the other. The duality is schizophrenic, and yet that is the norm. We will hire people to do jobs that are least competent to have our interests first at stake. And then we deny what our intuition tells us, that power corrupts everyone all the time, every institution, all of our institutions have betrayed us. Yet we stay embedded in the institutions because our story is one that we can repeat ad nauseum. And every time you talk to someone, how often do they repeat parts of that story to justify them being a victim? And you have to ask, can I change my story? Can I change my reality? The answer is yes, but not until you realize that almost everything in your story is an illusion. It's a conditioned response, believing in the wrong things. So at the end of the day, I will say that it was not cancer, heart disease, or a stroke that killed a person. It was their belief systems. Faulty belief systems are never discussed. Faulty bodies with symptoms are. So we treat the symptoms of all of our conditions, but never the underlying cause in any situation. Charles Eisenstein from Alternet, every culture has a story of the people to give meaning to the world, part conscious and part unconscious. It consists of a matrix of agreements and narratives and symbols that tell us why we are here, where we are headed, what is important, and even what is real. I think we are entering a new phase of the dissolution of our story of the people, and therefore, with some lag time, of the edifice of civilization built on top of it. Sometimes I feel intense nostalgia for the cultural mythology of my own youth, a world in which there was nothing wrong with soda pop, in which the Super Bowl was important, in which the world's greatest democracy was bringing democracy to the world, in which science was going to make life better and better. Life made sense. If you worked hard, you could get good grades, get into a good college, go to grad school, or follow some of the other professional paths, and you would be happy. With a few unfortunate exceptions, you would be successful if you obeyed the rules of society and you lived by the story you were given. If you followed the latest medical advice, kept informed by reading the New York Times and stayed away from bad things like drugs. Sure, there were problems, but the scientists and experts were working hard to fix them. Soon, a new medical advance, a new law, a new educational technique would propel the onward movement of life. My childhood perceptions were part of this story of the people in which humanity was designed to create a perfect world through science, reason, and technology, to conquer nature, transcend our animal origins, and engineer a rational society. From my vantage point, the basic premises of this story seemed unquestionable. After all, it seemed to be working in my world. Looking back, I realized this was a bubble world built atop massive human suffering and environmental degradation. But at a time when one could live within the bubble without need of much self-deception, the story that surrounded us was robust. It easily kept data points on the margins that challenged anything. Since my childhood, that story has eroded at an accelerating rate. More and more people in the West no longer believe that civilization is fundamentally on the right track. Even those who don't yet question its basic premises in any explicit way seem to have grown weary of it. A layer of cynicism, a hipster self-awareness, has muted our earnestness. What was once so real, say a plank in a party platform, today is seen through several lenses of mega filters to phrase it in terms of image and message. We are like children who have grown out of a story that once enthralled us, aware now that it isn't only a story. At the same time, a series of new data points has disrupted the story from outside. The harnessing of fossil fuels, the miracle of chemicals to transform agriculture, the methods of social engineering and political science to create more rational and just society. Each has fallen far short of its promise and brought unanticipated consequences that threaten civilization. We just cannot believe anyone anymore that scientists have everything well in hand, nor can we believe the onward march of reason will bring on social utopia. Today, we cannot ignore the intensifying degradation of the biosphere, the malaise of the economic system, the decline in health, or the persistence and indeed growth of global poverty and inequality. We once thought economists would fix poverty, political scientists would fix social injustice, chemists and biologists would fix environmental problems, the power of reason would prevail and we would adopt sane policies. I remember looking at maps of the rainforest decline in National Geographic in the early 1980s and feeling both alarm and relief. Relief because at least the scientists and everyone who reads National Geographic are aware of the problem now. So something surely will be done. Nothing was done. Rainforest decline accelerated, along with nearly every environmental threat that we knew about in 1980. Our story of the people trundled forward under the momentum of centuries, but with each passing decade, the hollowed-out nature showed us its core. That started perhaps with the industrial-scale slaughter of World War I, extending further. When I was a child, our society and systems of ideology were controlled by mass medias. We were protected within our story. But in all these decades since, the incursion of reality have punctured its protective shell and have ruptured its essential infrastructure. We no longer believe our storytellers, our elites. We no longer believe the politicians. We don't believe the doctors. We don't believe the professors. We don't believe the bankers. We don't believe the technologists. All of them imply that everything is under control, and we know that it is not. We have lost the vision of the future we once had. Most people have no vision of the future at all. This is a new dynamic in our culture and our future look. We thought we knew where society was going. The Marxists and the capitalists both agreed on its basic outlines, a paradise of mechanized leisure and scientifically engineered social harmony with spiritual enhancement. Of course, there were dissenters from this vision, but they were not controlling the consensus. In conclusion, when a story nears its end, it goes through a death row, an exaggerated semblance of life. So today we see domination, conquest, violence, and separation take on absurd extremes that hold a mirror up to what was once hidden and diffuse. In the year just spent, we have seen our stories disrupted. From the Sandy Hook massacre, even realizing that far more equally innocent children have been killed in the last few years by U.S. drone strikes, it really got under everyone's skin. No one was immune. I think that is because its utter senselessness penetrated every defense mechanism we have to maintain the fiction that the world is okay, but it's not. No one could say that Sandy Hook was more horrible than the Holocaust or the Stalinist purges or the imperialistic wars of the 20th and 21st centuries, but it was less comprehensible. Try as we might, we cannot fit it into our story of the world. It is the data point that unravels the entire narrative. The world no longer makes sense. We struggle to explain what it means, but with no explanation sufficing. We may go on pretending that normal is still normal, but this is one of the series of end-time events that is dismantling our culture's mythology. The evident futility of the responses that we are capable of imagining also points to the deep ideological breakdown. The responses are all about more control. Did we not hear? Put more guards in schools. Control more for guns. Create superstructures. And to what? More control. We do not need more control by bureaucracies, technocrats, oligarchs, special interest groups. All we need is to change our story and understand that most of what we've been living with has been a myth. Now it's time to create real stories based upon authentic self. I'm Gary Noll. I'm looking at the clock. We're coming to the end of this particular program. I would like to invite you to continue listening to the extended version by calling 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066, or continue listening on Progressive Radio Network. To all the other stations, we thank you very much and look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Let us now go to our calls and hear what people are interested in. Let's say hello to James from Queens. Hi, James. You're on the air.
Oh, good afternoon, Gary. Gary, I think in the sense that this bill that Obama signed will be an economic nightmare to the average American by raising taxes, taking away their Social Security that they're paid into, and really plunging the country right into a deeper depression where people have given false starts on figuring that, well, these politicians in Washington would help us out, but in reality they have stabbed us in the back. So I believe that we're in trouble.
We are in trouble, but the good news is that for those who are no longer willing to stay inside the myth of the corporate and social story and are willing to start over, then everything becomes a transcendence. When you adapt to the story, it's always against your interest. When you transcend the story, it's always to your betterment. So when I stop and you stop eating their food, watching their television, shopping in their box stores, putting money in their banks and believing in their bureaucracies as our answer, then we are free from that as individuals. All change must be at the individual level, but working towards common goals of shared responsibility. There are many of us. We are no longer a few. We are in the millions. We are actually in the tens of millions. So I see that the more we share this information with one another, our documentaries, our articles, our comments, then that empowers us. And this is the year of empowering people to stop, look out the keyhole to a different reality, and instead of being stimulated, titillated, amused, open the door, be inspired to take a step out. Once you do, into an enlightened state, you'll never want to be a part of that again. And that's where I see a quantitative shift coming now. Thank you very much. Let's say hello to Brian from New Jersey. Hi, Brian.
Hiya, Gary. Gary, just your last caller evaded to or said that, yeah, we know everything that's going wrong. What I see is, or what I want to know is, what's our next step? And I think you alluded to it. Stop shopping in their stores. Stop paying...
Tear up your credit card. All right? That's where they have you. Remember, that's a part of your story, that you need their credit card in order to buy their products that you don't need but are convinced you do need, to waste the stuff that we accumulate, turn off their television, start watching things that are empowering. Everything they share is disempowering. Stop participating in any activity that is of a violent nature. Stop listening to their politicians. Understand that when any politician out there, with few exceptions, open their mouth, they're going to lie. Understand that ALEC and the state legislators, including the corrupt little cesspool of New Jersey's legislature, cannot possibly ever do anything in your benefit. It is corrupted to the core. So when you pull yourself away from that, then look for the alternative sources of information and inspiration. And it's out there. Remember, Brian, this is the year where you and so many others are going to focus upon creating sustainable communities, and instead of everything for the individual. That's so important for progressives. For a democracy to exist in an authentic way, you must have people working together. You must have education and health and safety and justice and energy and communication. The things that we all have in common, you should not have that as a profit-making venture. That should be in the public commons. You should also look at Howard Zinn as a model rather than Ayn Rand as a model. She was narcissistic. She believed that a person's own world was all that mattered. Care for yourself, never anyone else. Zinn cared about people. We have misconstrued the power of high technology. We become a captive to it. Watch people, especially younger people in restaurants. Rarely do they ever look in each other's eyes or actually enjoy the meal. They're always looking down, twittering, or have their notepad and are Googling someone. We need to stop and slow down. We need to get ourselves prepared for the next step in our life. I appreciate what you're thinking and calling in and sharing it. Remember, we're for progress in solving problems. Everyone else in the room, in their story, is interested in the corporations they're part of making greater profits. I put people ahead of profits. I put progressive solutions ahead of defending the status quo. If only The Nation magazine and others would grow up and understand that. Let's say hello to Pam from New Jersey. Hi, Pam, your turn.
Hi, Gary.
We only have a minute, so make it quick.
Okay. I think BP should be made illegal not to drill anymore because they do criminal cutting corners and cause accidents. And someone told me that she thinks heard that the Gulf oil spill could turn into a fire explosion, like a high fire explosion.
That was a long time ago. Didn't happen, but it left environmental disaster around the entire rim of the Gulf, from Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, Florida, and Alabama. All of those states have people close to the water who are first responders or people worked in helping to clean it up who are now suffering absolutely devastating environmental illness, and we refuse to acknowledge this. I've been down there filming it, so I'm very familiar with how serious it is. And we'll take one more. Let's say hello to Desiree. Desiree, I don't know where you're from. Where are you from, Desiree?
Hi, Gary. I'm from Brooklyn, New York.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. What's up? We only have a second.
Okay. I wanted you to comment on two people, their work. The first is Willem Reich. R-E-I-C-H, he invented the orgone accumulator.
That's Wilhelm Reich.
Yes.
Yes.
And the second is Royal Rife, and he invented the Rife machine.
I believe that they were both brilliant. They were both eccentric. I happen to have met Rife's personal assistant. I saw the slides. They were thousands and thousands of them. I spent one whole day up in the near the Hudson, going through, this is in the 1970s, going through her slides that she had taken and hidden because they were out to get him because he had a way of creating a refracturing of light, and that would send a different vibration against viruses and bacteria and could kill them, including cancer cells. He was unquestionably one of the greatest scientists in world history. And Wilhelm Reich never was able to prove his argon therapy, but he was an extremely important voice for eclectic science at the time. Lou Anne Panessi. Lou Anne, you're the last word here today.
Hello, Gary. Well, just to punctuate the whole theme of your show, I received an article today about 8 hospital employees who were opposed to mandatory flu shots who got fired from their hospital. And I'm talking about oncology nurses, people who are vital to the staff. And they cannot make choices to not have a vaccine. The hospital made the vaccines mandatory. And if you don't follow the policies, that's grounds for being terminated. This can't be a union position, and even if it was, I'll bet that they would still get away with it. 8 mandatory hospital workers terminated from their jobs because they chose not to have vaccines for whatever their reasons were.
And I say good for them. They are outside the door. All the other nurses, all the other doctors, technicians who are working in the hospital getting their regular vaccines, they are refusing to accept that the story of it, their safety and efficacy, is wrong. These people sought information, sought insight, and realized that what they knew now transcended the false information. Today, I started researching and writing, along with our executive producer, Richard Gale, a major new article, which we hope to have ready by tomorrow and post on the flu vaccines. Look on our website by tomorrow. It'll be posted, and it will be the definitive work up to this point on why the flu vaccine is a fraud. And we will have it there for all the other nurses, doctors, and healthcare workers who wish to know the truth. Thank you. Let's now go over and say hello to Utrice Lead, standing by. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary, and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you.
I promise you it will be a happy one for me.
Great. Well, and what's going to be on your show today?
Well, we take a look at how Congress legislated so much power to itself to continually change the budget laws and still was unable and is unable to come up with a budget.
We look forward to it, Utrice. Starting a new year with Utrice Lead, Monday to Friday, from 1 to 2 right here on Progressive Radio Network. Utrice Lead in a second.